I was reading the coverage on the death of George Bush yesterday, the New York Times had this observation. They shared this reflection back from the convention in New Orleans in 1988, where George Bush was nominated. Bush underscored the theme of duty in accepting his party's nomination in 1988 in New Orleans. Bush said, "I am a man who sees life in terms of missions. Missions defined and missions completed." And he told the Republican delegates in the Louisiana Superdome, acknowledging a swell of applause, that he would keep America moving forward and strive for a better America. President Bush was an accomplished leader as he entered this presidential race, and he had been taught that such goal setting and achievement was both productive and was a path of virtue. And that message resonated deeply with those who were at the convention, and I think that crosses party lines. I think in the time that was really something that people were looking to hear. It was really sort of almost carrying forward something that almost felt like manifest destiny. We're settlers, and when I say settlers here, I'm thinking white settlers, landowner settlers, were to define a path and to conquer North America, plot a course, and achieve. And this was the pervasive American and I think Western civilization model. The business models of the 1950s and 60s and 70s were all about collecting more data, getting more data, figuring out charts, narrowing options, and trying to hone in on the very best answer to a problem somebody else had probably defined. I would note that some of that started changing in the 1980s and 90s, where some of the business models were looking at, I'll call it the softer side of decision making and leadership and intuition. People don't figure out an Apple iPhone by doing a trajectory of what was in the past and just keep doing it better. They took new thought. So some of those things were changing. And possibly in the path, that path that George Bush was familiar with, the path of the scientists that took us to land on the moon, they defined a target, and golly gee, were we successful at meeting those targets. And sure, there were a lot of innovations and technologies that were invented as they tried to figure out the moon. The only one I know about for sure is Tang, but I'm sure there were other things that were all part of that. And I know on a personal level, I helped my kids draw charts and taught them how to compare colleges. And my husband and I do pros and cons analysis for everything from who to have repair our roof and decisions of where to travel. I still have an old chart I did comparing the daycare centers in Arlington. But the mystical traditions I want to talk about, oh, mostly two pages. But think of the learned astronomer that Jerry just read about. In Walt Whitman's poem, we've got this guy, he's lecturing, and whether it's actually a student or whether it's the lecturer is a little unclear, but there's this urge to bolt from the room, to move from data about stars to be in the presence of stars. And my take is in that bolting from the room, the goal was not to then use the stars and the sky to be a lab to teach more about astronomy. It was just to be in the night with the stars, period. To be one with the universe, in this case literally, to have a sense of laying oneself aside and meld into the whole, to suspend achievement, to suspend problem solving. And it could be, we don't know, that maybe the person just needed to go outside to get some spiritual renewal, some night air, and then jump back into the mission of teaching. But what if? Just what if being fully awake to the mystery and that sense of oneness with a greater whole is the whole point? What if to just be is not only enough, but that's the it of living? What if a path to the greater good is about learning to just be? period. I'm going to do a quick look at a couple different world religions and how they do this, and know that I am not the expert. There are people in this room that know more than I do about any world religion. That is really clear. So I would offer their thoughts as we go through this. But when I think about Buddhism, I think that that's one of our closest places where just being is part of the goal. Nirvana is the highest state, and the goal is to be awake. And to awaken is about letting go of attachments to the body and the senses, and to be at one is about the Buddha nature. The goal is to be open and inquisitive and of good humor. And how does one get there? Through meditation. It's not about escape, but about honoring where one is in that moment. And I realize this is a dramatically oversimplified view, but it captures an alternative to a mission-grounded outlook on life, a grounding that is always about looking forward and doing more. When you think about this as a process of deep centering, about taking that sense of who our ego is and putting it aside. Whether this sounds to you sort of Buddhist or Taoist or like the Sufis in Islam, it is Unitarian Universalist as well. I was going to say right in the hymnal, but it turns out right on the back of your program, this congregation actually lists the sources of our faith before it lists the principles. And we have the seven principles, which we're called to affirm and promote, but we are also called to reach deep into many sources of, through world religions. But I call you to the first source of Unitarian Universalism is the direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to the renewal of the spirit and in openness to the forces which create and uphold life. The mystical traditions, they're not dwelling on a question of is there a God or not and that debate. With a debate I often hear followed in the Unitarians about the definitions of that God. Is it biblically based or metaphorically understood? Is it through incarnate leaders or Jesus? I think the mystical traditions through all of these different world religions go back a layer. They go to a more basic yearning that we have that was present in humans well before there were institutions of religions or traditional things that were recited. Mystics are searching the connections of the soul. Can you sense your ties to something beyond, to something really deep within? Can you feel the universe? Can you sense your breath? It's hard to know whether this mystical outlook came before or after this sense of personal achievement and accomplishment, but I do think it sometimes is the counterbalancing force that probably did go back to ancient times, where people said, how do we get back to the basics? In Thoreau's reading today, we heard, why should we live in such a hurry and waste of life? I wish to learn what life has to teach. What life has to teach. If we look across some of the traditions and we hear some of the different words, in the Native American tradition, words of Chief Leon Shenandoah, everything is laid out for you. Your path is straight ahead of you. Sometimes it's invisible, but it's there. You may not know where it's going, but you have to follow that path. It's the path of the Creator. It's the only path there is. It's not really, I don't hear that as a fateful outlook where everything is predetermined, but a trust in some sort of an unfolding that the path for each one of you is unique to you and it's yours to uncover and find. Taoism may look at the yin and the yang and look for balance. in the Hindu tradition, the goal is for your soul to be at one, and for you to know your soul, for you to be at peace with the Brahman, and to conscientiously live in the calm, in the fearless, in the selflessly loving life that comes when you are that deeply centered. Again, overly simplifying, but in the Hindu path, all the different yoga traditions are how one gets there and how one grounds. And the Christians also have the mystical path, and what a Christian mystic might be looking for is really to sense the presence of God. Translate that as you would like. Think about God as the underlying energy forces in the universe, wherever it is. But what helps someone get to that deepest level? One of the best known mystics in Christianity is Francis of Assisi, who Pope Francis actually modeled a lot of what he does afterwards. And one of the summaries about Francis of Assisi I found in the Washington Post describes him this way. Francis has been described as a nature mystic, one who finds God in the vast and beautiful fields of nature. Everything spoke to Francis of the infinite, the love of God. Trees and worms and lonely flowers on the side of the road, they were all saints gazing up to the face of God. And in this way, creation became the place to find God. And in finding God, he realized his intimate relationship with all creation. It's just not unlike our seventh principle, calling us to sense the interconnectedness we have with all. But I think this is also important about Francis of Assisi, is he did not consider himself to be at the top of a hierarchy, nor did he declare himself superior to non-human creation. Rather, Francis saw himself as a part of creation. His spirituality overturned the spirituality of hierarchical ascent and replaced it with a sense of solidarity between humanity and all creation. And as he came to do this more through his understanding of Christ, he came to realize his familial relationship to creation. And that meant to live in peace. And to live in justice is to live in peace. And it's this path, this sense of contemplation, that got Francis the title of being a mystic, his sense of oneness, his sense of God being present, the presence all around us, not a hierarchical sense. And for Christians, contemplative practices, initially you had the monks that would go off by themselves, but then it became more community practices. But the goal is, are you in a position to receive the divine gift, whatever that is? I think it's hard to do that in silence, and it's sometimes even harder to do that in the busyness of our days, but the tradition of all of these mystics is about making that time to be open to what is unfolding. So the Unitarian words again, being open to the direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder. Name that how you want to, but it may provide experiences with which offer you a sense of inner wholeness, a sense of deeper connection. It may actually feel like permission to just stop, to be fully open, because I do think it's stressful to define problems and solve them, and define problems and solve them over and over again, especially when many of these problems don't have solutions that are in our control. Don't get me wrong. Problem solving is not bad, and I will continue to make my charts. We choose to wear seatbelts and airbags. These things are good, and we're grateful for antibiotics and x-rays and the engineers and scientists who create these solutions. But in our analyzing, we do more than that. We also hopefully avoid toxic relationships and improve our parenting and make good consumer choices. So I don't think it's a choice between the mystical outlook or the problem solver's outlook. But figuring it all out is not possible. And trying to do so can just be wasted energy. It can even be unhealthy. In the Bible, we have the story of poor Job. He plays by all those rules, and yet he's plagued by misfortune, losing his children and his property. But he's a cause and effect kind of guy, and he attempts to figure it all out with God, and he's angry. What is going to make him feel safer and find fairness? Job's invited to learn that spending all your time trying to figure out why may not be the path that he's looking for to feel safer. Sometimes acceptance that some whys are just elusive is the path. And I'm challenging us to put that too in our spiritual toolkit. Rather than continually define, might we sometimes center and lay aside our ego and feel just something that we're connected to? I think there's another reason to have this in our spiritual toolkit. It's about understanding the other. How do some other people that are not folks that are the define it, fix it kind, what is their approach to life? And how do we sometimes view and judge others who have a different approach to life? I do believe, as I said before, it's not that it's a fate-controlled outlook, but a different way of seeing the next right step. And I know I have judged others that are not so enamored by logical drill-down approaches. There's comfort in the structure that fixes and that improves. And I think with age, I sense there's a lot of complementary wisdom in the intentional ways of just being aware, valuing intuition, and appreciating cycles. One of the secular readings about comparing sort of the mysticism to our more Western problem-solving approach is a book called Finite and Infinite Games by James Carse. He describes it this way. There are at least two kinds of games. One could be called finite, and the other infinite. A finite game is played for the purpose of winning, an infinite game for the purpose of continuing the play. Carse finds that finite games have beginnings and endings and rules that are clear. But he says infinite games, on the other hand, do not have a knowable beginning or ending. They are played with the goal of continuing play and the purpose of bringing more players into the game. An infinite game continues to play for the sake of the play. If the game is at risk of ending, then the rules have to be changed to allow for continued play. Where finite players strive to eliminate surprise and become masters, anticipating the whole game to figure out winning, infinite players play, on the other hand, in hope of being surprised. I think mystical traditions are about such surprise and hope. And while some of us have a tendency to try to define the rules of master life through prediction and problem-solving and mission-based looks, there is often meaning to be fully present at the unfolding path. Maybe that's why our UU sources remind us to look up, to look around us, and to look inward. To reflect and to contemplate and to play in hopes of being surprised. So as we approach the shortest day, we wait. Cultures offer holidays around solstice, that sense of being still, of being ready. Because I think it's often in the cold and the dark we are most ready to receive. We wait for the turning. There is promise in that waiting, and there is value in the preparing. Today actually begins Advent, and tonight is the first night of Hanukkah. These are times where we can be graced by our deepest connections to the stars, to the grandeur of the night, to the kindness of the other, and our sense of connection to all that have come before and those yet to come in this infinite game. Life. May we all be open to direct experience of the transcending mystery and wonder which moves us to the renewal of the spirit and openness to the forces which create and uphold life.